When historian Niall Ferguson moved from Harvard to Stanford 2 years ago, he was apparently struck by Silicon Valley's indifference to history. And the hubris he saw reminded him of what he encountered on Wall Street as he researched a book about the history of banking during the years before the financial crisis. He became convinced that the tech sector was careening towards its own crisis and decided to write about it. And the crisis has certainly arrived in full force this year, thanks to the likes of Cambridge Analytica, as well as Twitter's recent bot account purge, conveniently timed to coincide with the publication of Ferguson's new book on the history of social networks from the Freemasons to Facebook. It's called The Square and the Tower, and it's a cautionary tale that challenges the conventional wisdom that growing interconnectedness is inherently good for society. Our networked world is fundamentally vulnerable, and he writes that two-factor authentication won't save us. Ferguson is a well-known conservative historian, so his views will be controversial for some. But I was reminded of this while reading Western Cape Premier Helen Ziller's column in the Daily Maverick this week. And this is an idea that's been percolating with the increase of short and distraught tactics aided by anonymous Twitter accounts, most notably with regards to Capitec and Viceroy, and the amount of abuse meted out to various journalists. Intellidex chairman Stuart Theobald, chief among them, after he released his report on the infamous short seller Viceroy. So what are we to make of this new, almost post-truth interconnected world that we're living in? Well, to find out, I'm joined now by Western Cape Premier Helen Ziller. Evening, Helen, and welcome to the show.
Good evening, Michael. Good to be with you.
And on the line from London, we've got Stuart Theobald, the head or chairman of research firm Intellidex. Thanks for joining us, Stuart.
Hi, Michael. Good to be with you.
And in studio here in Johannesburg, Professor Raphael de Kutch, Professor of Political Science and Research Associate at the Helen Suzman Foundation. Professor, always a pleasure.
Very nice to be here with you and looking forward to the discussion.
Helen, you've had a love-hate relationship with Twitter, but the real weaponization, if we can call it that, started with the Bell Pottinger-inspired campaign to attack politicians, journalists, anyone who really spoke out against state capture. But you recently lost around 25,000 followers overnight after Twitter's much-publicized cleanup campaign started. How did that impact the tone of your timeline?
Well, the impact was immediate. Suddenly, the whole discussion was civil. Even where people disagree with me, they disagree with me in a civil way and have a different opinion, which everybody should be able to do. And suddenly I sensed that Twitter could be a platform that actually broadened democracy rather than shut down free speech.
Now, for listeners unfamiliar with these Twitter streets, can you just explain how the whole sock puppet, automated bots strategy works to target Twitter users and to really shut down that kind of free speech?
Well, I've learned a lot from reading about the benignly named Russian Internet Research Agency. And what they do is they research different ways of manipulating access to social media. In fact, just this morning, I've read about the decoy hashtag, which is a fascinating tool that they use to manipulate what people are reading and how they're reading it and what trends and what doesn't trend. So there are an infinite number, almost, it seems to me, of methods to manipulate this open platform. But a sock puppet is somebody who creates an account and then posts messages on that account pretending to be another person. So, for example, in the Trump campaign in the United States, a lot of people who were campaigning for Donald Trump actually gave themselves identities and pretended to be doing something else. An example would have been the prolific Blacktivist, as his handle had it. Blacktivist was his name. And his role was to pretend to be a radical left-wing black voter who was urging people not to vote for Hillary Clinton because she was a sellout. Now, that is a classic sock puppet. It is a person who has agenda A, to get Trump elected, pretending to be another person with agenda B to get black people to boycott Hillary Clinton because she's a so-called sellout. That is classic sock puppet stuff. And then when they created all those messages under a hashtag of a Blacktivist or a handle of Blacktivist, then a whole lot of bots, which is different from a sock puppet, a bot is an automated computer-driven account to just retweet these things to get huge volume and huge traffic. And so Blacktivist would be retweeted by a whole lot of robot accounts to make him look very popular, very supported, and to create an entire aura and messaging system around a fake tweet.
And Raphael, when we look at this, it really did first rise to prominence in the US, and now we're hearing details through the Mueller inquiry on how this sort of strategy can be used to swing an entire election, and it is rather alarming. It has some similarities, I guess, with the old Russian kompromat strategy of finding compromising information, but this is just a pure manipulation and using anonymous and often faceless bots on Twitter to swing and sway public opinion. One would think that it wouldn't have as much influence as it does, but quite clearly it can be quite a powerful weapon.
Yes, so I think
well, especially in open societies, you see, this is the great threat to democracy. I think those of us who live in open societies, and especially those of us who start from a liberal point of departure, always assume that other people are basically fair and rational. And that's a massive mistake. And I think the people who are used to the right to free speech think that people are going to differ with them, and sometimes even vehemently, but they aren't prepared for people pretending to be who they aren't. And then driving a whole computer network to amplify messages that are designed to manipulate outcomes. Mm, mm. Now, for me, that is a shock to the system. I mean, I can't even get my mind to work that way. And when you mention that it was emerged for the first time against people who were exposing state capture, no, Bell Pottinger was exposed well after it began. And the objective is this. The objective is to drive cleavages in society, to look for fault lines, and then to drive the society apart, to weaken the society. And that's what the Russians do, let's say, to the American society. There's a racial fault line. There's a class fault line. There's a religious fault line. Every fault line there is, they take, for example, the information from Cambridge Analytica and others, and they were, for example, posting to Christians, people who they could pick up from their Facebook posts and other things, that they were dedicated Christians, would send to her memes of Hillary Clinton with devil's horns, for example. It's that kind of targeting of manipulative and divisive posts to cleave open the potential fault lines in the society. And that was happening in South Africa a whole lot sooner. That's why when I posted, the legacy of colonialism was not only negative, that was seen as an immediate thing that could be distorted, decontextualized, and used to cleave open a society. And I am absolutely sure, you know, I can't be absolutely sure, but my thesis is that if we dig to the core of it, you will see a similar kind of network looking at any potential thing that can divide our society and using a network like Twitter, like Facebook, that is supposed to help people connect and help them broaden democratic dialogue, actually being used to broaden divisions in society, to increase polarization, and to kill people who are a danger to certain political interests.
To amplify those cleavages. Professor, how are you reading it? There's a lot of post-truth in this.
Well, I think we've got to look at the effect of the internet in relation to what Helen has spoken about. And one of the things that has emerged, and this became clear obviously in 2016, but actually there was evidence of this prior to that, and that is that what the internet has also done, specifically the social media such as Twitter and Facebook, Twitter being the most significant in terms of everyday political exchange, is that it has divided people into bubbles. That is to say, people tend to prefer, and there's been a recent MIT study which underscores this, people tend to prefer to hear things that are comforting, that keep them within their comfort zone. So they tend to want to hear things that they already believe to be the case or would prefer to believe was the case. And this has actually got in the way of really serious exchange because, and this was a point that Barack Obama, I thought, made extremely well in his speech at the Wanderers. And that is that in order for us to have a serious, civilized discussion around something that might be in one way or another contentious, we need to be able to agree on certain basic data, certain basic facts. And good policy, for example, and we know this, and this is one of the ironies coming out of the United States of America. In terms of social science, they are the leaders in terms of being able to articulate solid, methodologically well-grounded, evidence-based policy. But the problem with the bubbling effect, the creation of these bubbles, is that people no longer refer to these external parameters. They no longer refer to the external databases. They conduct discussions among themselves, reinforce one another's beliefs, usually or very often mythological type beliefs. And these lead, if you like, to partisanship. So what you're getting is instead of an engagement around commonly agreed upon information or data, you're getting the reinforcement simply of identities, of partisanship. And I think, if I can just add this, that this goes back to the collapse of state socialism, of the Soviet Union, the disappearance, if you like, of an alternative to liberal democratic capitalism. And it began not least on the left, people searching for a surrogate for an alternative to the class conflict discourse that was defining of Marxism in particular. And what you had was this move towards identity politics and the affirmation of what is known as viewpoint theory. So you would have a feminist theory of the state, or perhaps you could have a gay theory of the state, or you could have whatever. And this tended to close out a whole range of dialogues and discussions, because identities became less and less defined by where one was located in a social structure and more in terms of how one actually ascribed to oneself a whole set of obviously very often important and relevant properties. So what you got was this development of identity, which has now become a very strong feature of right-wing politics. And I follow Twitter very closely. And what I found there is that the identity politics has become even more pronounced when it comes from right-wing sources. Very often, I'm not quite sure, coming back to Helen's point, whether the sources are authentic or not. And perhaps I could just add one extra point in here. It's a very quick one. And that is that there are ways, and I think we should talk about this, of navigating one's way through Twitterdom.
Well, that is a very good point to depart from, because that's where we want to get to. How do we become more streetwise and savvy with our engagements with social media, knowing that there are forces out there that want to use it for nefarious aims? And also we have this tendency, as Niall Ferguson calls it, of homophily, the fact that we have an inclination to be attracted by people like ourselves. It's a network science theory called homophily. Birds of a feather flock together, and large social networks create an easier pathway for people to cluster into like-minded subgroups. Now, Stuart, you recently released a report into the short seller Viceroy, which, among other things, just demonstrated how it largely plagiarized its research into Steinhoff, but more importantly, how murky its business model is, who funds it, and that sort of thing. But the reaction to the report also shows how social media allows harassers to attack critics and journalists, anyone really with a different opinion, with impunity. What has your experience been since releasing that report?
Well, we had a number of sock puppets, as Helen says, springing up to attack us in various ways, also supported by bots in some cases, to not only attack us, but also to attack other people who I think were assumed to be related or somehow engaged with us, either as sources of information or as perhaps some kind of allyship, so deceiving us as all belonging to some kind of concerted campaign. And I think that, you know, those sorts of attacks are really designed to intimidate. So for an investment researcher, I think much like a journalist, if someone doesn't like what you're saying about their company, they can go to take to social media with an intimidation and harassment campaign in the hope of shutting you up. But what's interesting about the whole intersection of short selling and social media is that social media, much like it can be used to distort the democratic process, can also be used to distort financial markets. Now, manipulating share prices is nothing new. That's been happening for a long time. But using social media to do it is a growing phenomenon and a growing problem for regulators. So via social media, you can create sock puppets. You can dress them up as sort of internal leakers from a company that they can then spread false information, alleging all kinds of dramatic, price-sensitive details about a company. You can have a bot army flaming those rumors, retweeting, and so on. And if you get it right, you can have a dramatic impact on the share price of a company, which allows short sellers to bank a big profit. And the inverse works as well. You know, you can take a long position in a share and then spread information that leads to a rapid share price increase as well. So both of those are forms of market manipulation. And social media has made it possible to do a whole lot of things that weren't possible before, at least not able to be done as quick as they used to be able to be, as they can be done now.
And for me, Stuart, it places the role of the financial journalist just as much as the political journalist front and center. We've had massive budget cuts in newsrooms across the country. We've seen a lot of thinning out of newsrooms, junior reporters being employed because they're on cheaper salaries. They might not be as streetwise or savvy as some of their more experienced peers, and misinformation campaigns are driven through these back doors, if you will. So I think here that it really is incumbent upon the Fourth Estate to increase its focus on training for the financial media, and equally for any reporter to guard against this in a world where misinformation is increasingly being employed as a tactic.
Yeah, so, you know, some information is complex, particularly financial data and research on a share can be done in very long, comprehensive reports that are very difficult for lay people to read and understand. And it really depends on the media to be able to interpret that information for a lay audience. And some of the manipulation schemes use this because they know if they create information that looks complex, it's much more readily taken on face value. And it really takes people with skills who are used to dealing with complex financial information to look at it critically and assess whether it's high quality or not. And the media needs to play a kind of gatekeeping role in doing that. I think we're in a state of flux as a society. We're still learning, I think, how to interpret and understand social media. And it's not unlike, I think, what happened a century ago in traditional media, where there was a process of professionalization of journalism and newsrooms and standard settings, and we created things like editors' forums and so on, where certain standards could be applied. And to your point of the paucity of resources in newsrooms, you know, partly that is a function of increased competition that has been created by the online media realm. If you actually sum up the amounts that are spent on news gathering worldwide, those amounts have probably increased. They haven't reduced, but it has been fractured between a great many more outlets. And it might be that we're just in an adjustment process where that'll reverse. And as the public at large becomes more eager to see high quality media and high quality information from the outlets that they want to consume from, the pressures will change. And I think we're already seeing it. You know, a business like the New York Times, I think Donald Trump has given a whole new lease of life. and I think the American public has come to recognize that it's very important to have well-resourced media outlets that are critically examining information out there in order to be able to help us make judgments over what we should take seriously and what not.
Helen, what does all of this mean for us here in South Africa? We've been speaking in very broad brushstrokes and at a high level around some of the theory, but as far as the state cleanup project being driven by the new president, well, we hear that the forces of state capture are regrouping, if you will. There have been warnings by Public Enterprises Minister Pravin Gordhan that we can expect a second wave of attack.
You know, Michael, I don't think people understood that in order to get as far as they did, the Guptas needed to have very long pipelines of people. I can't tell you how difficult it is in government to spend 25 cents without the right processes. And if you're stealing billions, you must have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people doing things they shouldn't be allowed to do. And so Cyril Ramaphosa is in an impossible position. Does he clean them all out? If he doesn't, they're going to be fighting back and continuing doing what they are. If he does, he's going to split the ANC in half and probably won't be able to stay in power. He's got a very tough choice to make. He either splits the party or accommodates the state capturers in his bosom and they will continue the fight back because they don't want to be exposed. That is the difficult choice. I don't think anybody understands how deep this cancer is. If you've got cancer of the liver, you can't take off a mole off your nose. This is a very, very serious and deep thing. And when you speak about the Fourth Estate, I have to smile because state capture was led in large part by, for example, the buyout using the front of the Public Investment Corporation, which is state employees' pension funds, to enable the buyout of the independent group, the largest English newspaper group, which then just became a spokesperson for that side of the ANC. And we saw, for example, ANN7 and the New Age, which is now folding, but all of these were part of the project.
Mm.
And the other thing, when you start talking about the role of the judiciary and the role of the journalists, please focus on the role of opposition politicians. I've been talking about state capture since the early 2000s. Not in that phrase. I used that phrase for the first time in 2013, long before any journalist used that phrase. I've been speaking about centralization of power, cronyism, corruption, and the criminalization of the state. In that order. We have a criminal state. It is more than state capture. We have had, under Jacob Zuma, a criminalized state. And when you have so many criminals in critical positions, what is Cyril Ramaphosa going to do? And when the laws that I've been exposing all the way through and was called a racist for my troubles, arguing that the BEE laws are just a nice fig leaf for the process of criminalizing the state, which is exactly what has happened. So people must listen a little bit more to some opposition politicians who've put this onto the table decades ago when it was very unpopular to do that. Tony Leon did that. I did that. We were all called racist for our trouble because people said, no, you don't want black people to advance. That's obvious, which is, of course, a complete lot of nonsense. We don't like fig leaves to cover corruption with a nice moral-sounding name. And now all of that is coming home to roost, and a few more journalists, frankly, should have seen through it.
We could throw the SARS rogue unit story that was led through a very well-known Sunday paper into that lot as well. That said, though, Helen, and I want Professor De Kutt just to wade in here.
Yes, I'd like to firstly endorse Helen's point and signal also that this is a more general, more global problem than perhaps we realize. Reading about, for example, the manipulation of information and the attempt to control news in places like Malaysia, Egypt, which some people have referred to as arguably the biggest prison house for journalists in the world. I don't know what the actual data are, but the point is that there's a fundamental tension. And this is a point that the great German sociologist Max Weber made in his two famous lectures, Science as a Vocation and Politics as a Vocation. There's a fundamental tension between politics as the pursuit of power and the attempt to gain control over the allocative processes in a society, and science, which is concerned with establishing what the actual facts, what the actual status of affairs is. And where science comes into collision with power, with the pursuit of political objectives and ends, there's a very strong disposition on the part of political agents, whether they are actually in power or out of power, to attack and to actually discredit what those who are doing scientific work claim. Now, of course, science itself is open to error, but one of the defining features of science is that it acknowledges that its own progress involves the acknowledgement that error is a key part of what has to be corrected. Where you're dealing with mythologies, where you're dealing with self-serving beliefs, that, of course, is not the case. And this really leads me to the point that I raised earlier on, which is how does one actually, because I think, like it or not, the internet, the social media platforms, not least Twitter, have invited this process of people only taking note of those who agree with them, what they have to say. There are ways of actually managing that. And I think that it takes one back, in fact, to an old battle between the press and politicians. And I'm thinking of the collision between Baldwin and Lord Beaverbrook back in 1931, or the old German line when information was disconfirming of what Nazi propaganda put out, the Lügenpresse, the lying press. There are actually ways in which we can correct for that, and I actually have some strategies which I will share if we have time.
We do have a little bit of time towards the back end here, but just a little bit. So, Stuart, I want to finish off from a business and perhaps from a different angle, looking at the fangs and looking at the rise of Facebook and Amazon and Google. There is an increasing call around the world to regulate these businesses because they become so large and so powerful. And Niall Ferguson in particular, and this is quite an interesting view from Ferguson because he is a conservative historian, as I said, reckons that these, specifically the social medias, have become far too big, and he likens them to the development of Gutenberg's printing press. And what happened then, over 500 years ago, we had Martin Luther thinking naively that if everybody could read the Bible in the vernacular, that have a direct relationship with God and would create this priesthood of all believers and everything would be awesome. Well, what we saw was actually something quite different. It was used as a decentralized communication tool to spread different ideas. There was 130 years of escalating religious conflict. It culminated in the 30 Years' War. And what one could see was a lot of polarization. There were a lot of similarly fake news type stories. We had witches being burnt at the stake. And Ferguson reckons that we're at the risk of an even bigger network typed polarization as a result of social media in our business and our politics. Would you go along with such a dystopian view?
I suppose the disanalogy with the printing press is that printing presses are very expensive, so it requires capital in order to have one, and then you control what is produced. And social media is extremely cheap for people to access, so you have a very diverse range of voices that can come across. But I think the point about creating echo chambers and creating divisive groups that social media enables is really important. And we're not, you know, I don't think we're quite clear as to what the long-term impact is going to be. But I'm not as pessimistic as some people. You know, I broadly support someone like Steven Pinker's view that on the whole, we're still trending towards less social violence and greater cooperation and respect for difference. I think we're going through a phase, Trump and Brexit and other kinds of populist movements in Europe and elsewhere, that, you know, I hope are really the tail end of a backlash against what is broadly, you know, a trend towards greater equality, both in a financial sense, but also equality in access to the airwaves and access to debates and ideas. So I'm not as pessimistic, but we do have a lot of thinking to do. We do need to regulate things properly. We do need to prevent, just using these technologies to achieve harassment and also to manipulate people. And we've got to think through those problems and solve them. But there is a lot of work being done. And as the CAT has indicated, there are good ideas about ways we can manage these things. I've seen other work done by academics on how we can actually introduce mechanisms into social networks that allow for good ideas to rise to the surface in opposed to bad ideas. You know, all so both technology and regulation can direct social media to have a broader, a more positive net effect on our societies. And I think we can get there. I don't think we should panic, and I don't think we should think the end is nigh.
Well, lots to consider. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. So, Professor, I'm going to have to invite you back, and we'll discuss some of those strategies to help us navigate through an increasingly difficult, minefield-ridden arena of social media amongst all of this disinformation and sock puppets and bots and that kind of thing. Great thanks to all my guests tonight, Western Cape Premier Helen Ziller, Stuart Theobald, the chairman of research firm Intellidex, and Professor Raphael de Kut, a research associate at the Helen Suzman Foundation. Let's cross now to Arabile Gamede, co-host of Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. What do you have lined up for tomorrow, Mr. G?